of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 7th, 2024. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and we look at the front page of today's Gazette. First, UI Hospitals Addresses Workforce and Student Needs by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette in Iowa City. The expansive University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics employs more than 20,000, including over 5,000 nursing staffers, and yet, given its growth and a nationwide healthcare worker shortage, that's not enough. At the start of April, UIHC was looking to fill more than 360 nursing-related jobs, according to UI Employment website, a figure that could swell next year with the debut of its new $525.6 million, 469,000-square-foot hospital in North Liberty. And a search on the UI job site for open patient care technician positions indicates more than 550 spots available. We talk a lot about the nursing shortage, UIHC nurse manager Jessica McDaniel said, but we oftentimes didn't talk about our patient care tech shortage. Hoping to address the employment demands alongside academic needs for its students in training, the University Healthcare Enterprise recently partnered with the UI College of Nursing for what could serve as a win-win-win. By hiring students for a new unit partner position, the university aims to give them invaluable experience while also supporting the workload of hospital staff and enhancing patient care. The unit partner program, according to the university, provides an extra set of hands to nurses and patient care technicians at the hospital, alleviating demands on hospital staff, while exposing students, many of whom are planning careers in healthcare, to work in a hospital setting. More than 200 students since the program piloted in 2022 have served as unit partners, supporting both nurses and patient care technicians by, for example, setting up meals, bathing patients, stocking and retrieving supplies, checking blood sugar levels, and offering basic patient companionship. "I love going on walks with patients," said Sashin Fong, 19. "Some people, they're not able to get up on their own. They need to have a staff member with them in case they suddenly feel a little lightheaded and need somebody to grab a wheelchair and just put it behind them, or follow them, or just need a hand to hold on to. You learn so much about people by just walking with them." UI nursing student Fong, now a sophomore, started in the unit partner program last year as a freshman, before the experience gave him the confidence to advance into a patient care technician role. Today, in the job giving him direct patient assignments, Fong works 4 days a week for a total of 20 hours, while also balancing a full academic load. His hours were about the same as a unit partner, a position he found almost accidentally during freshman orientation, having already determined his nursing major. In seeking starter opportunities to work at the hospital, Fong, before classes even began, was surprised to receive two offers. He could jump right in as a patient care tech or start as a unit partner. Being new to college, the state, and patient care, Fong opted for the less intimidating unit partner option, allowing him to make his schedule of 2 to 16-hour shifts on any days that worked for him. "You can schedule yourself as much as you want, it's flexible with school, and you're allowed to basically assist anybody," said Fong from Naperville, Illinois, where his dad worked as a cardiovascular intensive care nurse. "You can assist nurses, sometimes physicians, any radiology technicians. You're able to assist with and help with just day-to-day stuff." Fong waited only 3 weeks into classes before starting as a unit partner. A typical shift for him would involve simply walking in and looking for ways to help. "I don't have to say, today I'm going to stock or today I'm going to talk to patients," he said. "It's just whatever people need help with. It can be a little things, like your patient had a nurse call button on. You could walk in and be like, 'Hi, how's it going? What do you need?' And then you can walk around. I always do loops around our unit. And I'll just check in with all the nursing assistants and nurses, and I'll be like, 'Do you guys need anything?'" Fong said he appreciated the option of non-patient-involved tasks, at least initially. "As a beginner, I was kind of nervous," he said. "I was like, I don't know if I'm ready to be assigned patients." Over time, though, he gravitated toward those he said improved his patient interaction skills. "You can help with a patient who might be feeling lonely. Just saying, 'Yeah, let me go sit down and talk to them,'" Fong said, reporting those tasks helped him to just be able to walk in a room and feel comfortable doing it. The program currently has 40 to 50 unit partners. And while it's open to students of all majors, about 80% have come from the College of Nursing. In fact, in an effort to remove traditional employment barriers for new students juggling coursework, Lou said they've streamlined the application process by attaching notices to College of Nursing acceptance letters. That is Dan Luce, UIHC Nursing Director of Medical Surgical Services. Instead of a full application and interview process, students can send in resumes. And instead of requiring 40-plus hours of orientation common for patient care techs, student unit partners can start right away. Our students couldn't give 40 hours a week, he said, so often we would get people who wanted to help and join our team in September, but they couldn't really start until December when school was on break. So this position, this program allows them to join our team in September, Lou said. Then if they decide, I do want to become a patient care tech, then they would complete that in December or January when they're on break. Although unit partners are paid, they earn less than patient care technicians. We knew we had to create a gap between the higher level role that has more responsibilities, Lou said. We've received tremendous feedback from our staff about how helpful and beneficial the unit partners are, Nurse Manager McDaniel said. What surprised me is how much the addition of unit partners to our team has increased our morale and teamwork. And also from the front page, Iowa women's basketball team draws wide range of fans in Cleveland, by John Stepp of the Gazette. In Cleveland, the 3:30 a.m. wake-up call, the 4 a.m. start of the drive, the 7 hours in the car, the vehicle running out of gas on the Ohio Turnpike, the $600 tickets, all of it. It's worth it, Allison Hanselman said without hesitation. The mother from Mekon, Wisconsin, even called it a no-brainer. It's history, Hanselman said, standing outside Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse with her 11-year-old daughter, Kaylee. I want her to see it and remember it. The Hanselman family's mother-daughter trip was... Where is the second half of this story? Apologies, it was on page 9. I thought it was on page 10. The mother-daughter trip was one part of a vast patchwork of fans, from newly minted Iowa fans to those who have been invested in the program for decades, who made the, in many cases, expensive pilgrimage to Cleveland to see Caitlin Clark and the Hawkeyes in the Final Four. Allison and Kaylee Hanselman became Iowa fans last year, the year when Clark scored 27.8 points per game en route to winning National Player of the Year the first time. They also support UConn's K.K. Arnold, who is from neighboring Germantown, Wisconsin, but Clark was the main appeal for the last-second adventure. Kaylee's favorite part about Caitlin Clark? Shooting threes, Kaylee said as she wore her Caitlin Clark jersey, which was an Easter gift, and a homemade Iowa bracelet. On the other side of the Iowa fandom spectrum, Becca McCann was among the former players who witnessed Iowa advance to its second straight national championship game Friday. McCann was on Lisa Bluter's first four teams at Iowa. To see this for the coaching staff that I got to play for and watch them star in all they've done over the years, I couldn't be happier, McCann said. There's not a staff out there that has worked harder for this. McCann was there with her husband, Robert Gallery, the former Iowa football great. Their children, who are unsurprisingly big Iowa women's basketball fans, were not so fortunate. They're not happy with us, that's for sure, McCann said, but we got to take them back to the Ohio State game at Carver this year just last month, so they got to see that. Carol Rowland, a 58-year-old from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, made the trip up with five other family members of varying generations. She had some holy help on Friday as she rooted for the Hawkeyes. I'm working for two different groups of religious sisters, Dominicans and Daughters of Charity, and they're all praying for a victory, Rowland said ahead of Friday's game while waiting to get into an iClub event. Rowland initially was thinking about just giving some money to her niece and great-niece so they could attend, but her boss, a Notre Dame alum and big Notre Dame women's basketball fan, encouraged Rowland to spend a little more and attend as well. A younger member of the family pulled the trigger on tickets at just the right time. It was like the commercial where it was like, wait, 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 now, Rowland said. I have no idea how much we spent, but I'm contributing. Resale tickets eventually fell from the four-digit figures from earlier in the week, but they still were far from a bargain. The cheapest ticket on StubHub for Friday and Sunday sessions as of Friday about 90 minutes before tip-off was $696 each after fees. Someone just wanting to see Friday night semifinals game could have grabbed a single ticket in the 17th row of the upper deck for $337 after fees. Want to bring a friend? You would have to pay at least $374 each. Janice Schmidt from Rockford, Illinois, and her daughter Emily Jacobson from Evanston, Illinois, benefited from extra tickets in the family. Aunt Mary has two extra tickets, Jacobson remembers Schmidt telling her during last Monday's Elite Eight game. I'm like, yeah, we're going. You feel like it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for a Hawkeye fan. Schmidt never actually watched women's basketball until the Hawkeyes' March Madness run last year. Now she absolutely plans to keep watching next year, even after Clark is off to the WNBA. As for Allison Hanselman and her daughter Kaylee's eventual 27 hours or so, they decided to leave at 7 p.m. the night before, and she learned 20 miles to empty on her car does not actually mean 20 miles to empty. I thought my engine died, and then I'm like, oh, I think I ran low on gas, Hanselman said. I think the gauge was off. A little bit, her father chimed in. The native Clevelander's parents lived only 10 miles away, though, so her father picked her up with plenty of time to spare. By the time they were venturing around the fan or entertainment area outside Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse, they were all smiles. After all, they were about to see Caitlin Clark. "We're super excited," Hanselman said. Turning to the Iowa Today and the Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state under the heading In the News, postpartum Medicaid changes pass, qualifying Iowa mothers would get Medicaid coverage for longer, but hundreds of others would lose coverage under a bill House lawmakers sent to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk this past week. The bill would extend postpartum Medicaid coverage to 12 months, but lower the eligibility for pregnant women to qualify for Medicaid from 375% of the federal poverty line to 215%. The changes would make Iowa one of the last states to extend Medicaid coverage of postpartum care from 2 months to 12 months, an option made available in the Federal American Rescue Plan Act in 2021. The change would mean an estimated 1,700 mothers and infants would no longer qualify for the program. Around 2,700 women each month who would have otherwise lost coverage after 60 days will receive it for 12 months. More options for Boy Scout victims. Iowa lawmakers are working on a legislative fix to allow men who were sexually abused while in the Boy Scouts of America to claim a larger settlement as part of the organization's bankruptcy lawsuit. The bill will waive the statute of limitations for civil claims for only that case, allowing Iowans who are part of the lawsuit to recover more money. Reynolds signs Religious Freedom Bill. Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill this past week that will give more legal protections to people who claim their religious liberty has been infringed. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, modeled after legislation in other states, requires courts to apply strict scrutiny, the highest legal standard, in religious liberty cases. Opponents worry the bill gives people free range to discriminate based on their religious beliefs. Voter fraud sentencing. Kim Taylor, the Sioux City woman convicted of 52 counts of voter fraud, will serve 4 months in prison and 4 months on house arrest throughout 2020, Taylor filled out and signed ballots on behalf of Vietnamese residents with limited English proficiency in order to influence votes for her husband, who was elected to a Woodbury County Board of Supervisors position that fall after losing a U.S. House primary election. Taylor faced a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison for each of the 52 counts. The judge cited Taylor's lack of criminal history and her role as caregiver for 6 children and her mother as reasons for the lighter sentence. Taylor will also have to pay a $5,200 fine. Man charged for 35-year identity theft. A former University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics employee has pleaded guilty to an extensive identity theft scheme in which he had been living under another man's name for more than 30 years, causing the other man to be falsely imprisoned and sent to a mental hospital. Matthew David Kierens, 58, was convicted of crimes punishable by up to 32 years in prison. Hemp regulations pass. Iowa Senate lawmakers passed a bill regulating the THC content and sale of hemp products, sending the bill to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk for a signature. The bill would cap the THC content of hemp projects at 4 milligrams per serving and 10 milligrams per container and impose civil and criminal penalties on non-compliant businesses. Under the heading, they said, "I absolutely want to see the most of this money go to the moms and babies who need it the absolute most for a longer period of time." Representative Devin Wood, Republican New Market on postpartum Medicaid changes, and this bill opens the door for a business to deny services to an LGBTQ+ patron, a landlord to evict a single mom because she's not married, for a pharmacist to deny a birth control prescription on religious grounds. Representative Lindsey James, Democrat Dubuque on religious liberty bill. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Iowa Park Rangers. Iowa no longer will have park rangers under a new plan by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Instead of being assigned to specific parks, the rangers will be classified as conservation officers and assigned to one or more counties. Caitlin Clark Awards. Iowa women's basketball star Caitlin Clark took home 2 top awards this past week ahead of the team's Final Four appearance. Clark was named AP's Player of the Year and the 2024 Naismith National Player of the Year, winning both honors for the second consecutive year. Clark has shattered records this season and is the presumptive first pick in the upcoming WNBA draft. Under the heading Water Cooler, Gender Balance Act, Iowa's boards and commissions will no longer be required to have an equal number of men and women after Governor Kim Reynolds signed a law repealing the requirement. Republicans passed the bill this year, arguing that the need for gender-based quotas has passed and applicants should be selected on their merit. Education Director confirmed, Governor Kim Reynolds, picked to lead the State Department of Education, was confirmed this past week over the protest of Democrats who argued she did not have enough experience in public education. Mackenzie Snow is a former Trump administration official and has held senior posts in the education departments in New Hampshire and Virginia. Turning to the Insight page, first a column from editorial fellow Sophia DiMartino, The Dubuque Renaissance, DEI Expressed Through the Arts. It is snowing when I meet arts entrepreneur Brianna Thompson at The Spot, a local Black-owned business in Dubuque. She hustles through the door, long locks piled high on her head like a crown, frosted with the falling snow. The photographer and graphic designer spent her formative years in Chicago. After completing her undergraduate studies in graphic design at Jackson State, a historically Black university in Mississippi, Brianna relocated to Dubuque at the encouragement of family who live in the area. As a new grad, she was in pursuit of opportunities to use her skills. Culturally, Dubuque was a little different to what I was used to. I didn't have mentors in my field who I could look up to. I had to go to the library to find people like me. In her search for relatable mentors, Brianna found historical figures. In their stories of pioneering and overcoming, she could envision forging her own path. Langston Hughes, Countess Vaughn, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, Fred Hampton. In studying these giants, I knew that my purpose was bigger. I wanted to implement programs that represented our culture in a positive light. For me, that has always been art. It was also this unfilled need for mentorship that led Brianna to become a mentor for youth in partnership with the Multicultural Family Center of Dubuque. I was that 21-year-old who would have taken any opportunity. That's how much I loved photography. But not having the support system and the resources to foster my craft and also managing all of the trials and trauma that I went through as a Black gay woman in this town, I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. We don't have the luxury to not care. If we don't care, how can we expect anyone else to care? Investing that positive energy in a 17, 18-year-old makes me feel like I'm really aligning myself with purpose that God has for my life. It's bigger than me. Brianna's search for a purpose-driven career path came to fruition in the location where we sit for our interview. The Spot, a shake shop a couple of blocks from the riverfront, has served as a gathering place for many young Black students and professionals in Dubuque. I used to come here twice a week. I would come to meditate and release the pressures of life on a cultural, political, and spiritual level. It's a safe space. They open their doors to any type of community and give back to many of the nonprofits in town. That's just who they are. I would come in upset and wanting to do something. At first, I didn't know what to do. I grew up engulfed in every type of medium and art in Chicago. Not having that here, that's what I wanted to fill my soul with. At this time, 2 years ago, I wasn't seeing anything locally that represented Black History Month. I had my first event right here at The Spot, Black As You Are. Will you tell me more about that event? Black As You Are is an art exhibition and spoken word poetry slam. I had artists from all over the tri-state, Iowa City, Davenport, Cedar Rapids, Des Moines. I didn't know them before the event, and most of them had never even been to Dubuque before. The event drew a crowd of 200 attendees, including Dubuque's mayor and people from as far as Chicago, Philadelphia, and Milwaukee. Brianna's success with this and subsequent cultural and arts-focused events has granted her access to a seat at many of the most prestigious tables in town. I sit on the boards of the Dubuque County Fine Arts Society, was part of Dubuque Fest, the Committee for Arts on the River, the advisory board for the Dubuque Museum of Art. The more art opportunities I have, the more I am noticing there aren't many people who look like me in these spaces. Representation is everything. What does it mean for you to be a mentor for someone now? It's impactful work. I have to be intentional with my words, something I've never been good at before. I'm used to saying what I want. That's the artist in me. But when you take on a moral obligation, when you say I want to be a voice for the voiceless, you have to be universal in your ability to articulate to a demographic of people who are culturally ignorant of what you stand for. That requires a lot of grace, patience, education, empathy, and compassion. Last year, Brianna started a small business called Arts for Us. The talent management and creative consulting business still is finding its footing, but has already put on a fashion show featuring 7 local designers. They also offer support to other organizations working to diversify cultural programming. Yeah, I'm really thankful for this community. Where I come from, it's hard. My father was in and out of prison. My mother worked 3 jobs and owned a business. My aunties and grandparents picked up what my parents couldn't give. When you grow up with a community of Black women raising you, pouring into you, naturally you want to be what you were taught. I was raised to care about community. At 30, Brianna has had several job offers from other states, but chooses to continue to build community here in Iowa. Althea Cole writes in her To a Candid World column, Is Religious Freedom Act a license to discriminate? Last week, Governor Reynolds signed Iowa's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, While some hailed it as state-level protection of religious freedom, mirroring that at the federal level, others decried it as a license to discriminate. I'd be less suspicious of the latter characterization if opponents of the bill had more clear-cut examples of discrimination. In a news release bemoaning passage of the bill, Planned Parenthood advocates of Iowa gave some examples of how they claimed the 1993 Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act enabled discrimination. They were interesting. One claim detailed how the law allowed craft store giant Hobby Lobby to deny insurance coverage for birth control. It didn't mention that it was only certain types or the other ways a woman can obtain free or low-cost birth control, including from, well, from Planned Parenthood. Another PPAI claim cited a funeral home claiming the right under the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act to terminate a transgender employee for violating its dress code by dressing as their identified gender. It did not mention that the U.S. Supreme Court, through the exact same federal process that Iowa's new law establishes at the state level, rejected the funeral home's arguments, siding with the fired employee. PPAI's last and most interesting claim stated that the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act allowed a member of a polygamous Mormon sect to refuse to cooperate in a federal investigation into the group's alleged continued violations of federal labor law. Technically, it was true. But like Planned Parenthood's other claims about the law, the example of the polygamous Mormonist lacks context, leading a person to conclude too hastily that the RFRA gives bad people a free pass from important laws. To understand whether the federal religious freedom law actually enabled child exploitation, it's worth looking at the case and considering the actual standards set by religious freedom protections. Utah construction business Paragon Contractors Corp. and its owners were already under a permanent injunction barring them from violating the Fair Labor Standards Act after the court determined that the business had violated the portion of the law prohibiting oppressive child labor. Paragon is owned by Brian Jessup, a leader in the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a tight-knit, highly secretive polygamous group that exerts control over all aspects of its followers' lives, and it's invariably considered a cult. Starting in 2008, Paragon contracted with a pecan ranch in southern Utah to harvest pecans, receiving 30% of the ranch's pecan harvest proceeds. In 2012, CNN aired a chilling video of hundreds of church members, mostly children, many of them small children, working on the pecan farm. The video prompted investigators from the Department of Labor to open an investigation into whether Paragon was involved in violation of the existing injunction. It was during this investigation that Virgil Steed, who was believed to work for the polygamous sect and have knowledge about it, refused to answer questions about the church's role in organizing and transporting the children to work at the Pecan Ranch. Steed cited his First Amendment rights to the free exercise of religion, which he said would be violated if he were compelled to answer the government's questions. After a magistrate judge recommended that Steed be made to answer investigators' questions, a district court stepped in and ruled that Steed's objection must be reviewed according to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Under that law, the Labor Department had not shown that forcing Steed to answer questions in violation of his religious belief was the least restrictive means of fulfilling the government's compelling interest to obtain the information it was seeking. Compelling interest and least restrictive means are loaded terms. They're the bread and butter of the RFRA at both the state and federal level, but they also show how the law doesn't actually give a free pass to just anyone citing any religious rights. Rather, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act allows a person's right to free expression of religion to be overridden if the government has a compelling interest in doing so, and if doing so is the least restrictive means by which the government can advance its compelling interest. The court did not find that forcing Steed to answer questions was the least restrictive means of gathering information vital to the investigation, because investigators still had the ability to seek the information from other sources, including Paragon owner Jessup and an agent of the business who testified to facilitating hundreds of kids and their parents to collect nuts on the Pecan Ranch. Opponents of Iowa's law claim that such religious freedom laws are used to violate the rights of women and LGBTQ plus people in the name of religion. They seem to have no problem when laws are used to violate religious freedom in the name of women's and LGBTQ plus rights. They haven't batted an eye so far. In the name of women's rights, the Affordable Care Act's contraception mandate violated the religious freedom of Dort College, now Dort University in northwest Iowa. Dort has a strong and clearly stated affiliation with the Christian Reformed Church, which objects to contraceptives that prevent pregnancy post-fertilization. But the ACA's original religious exemption applied mainly to churches and not to religious nonprofits such as schools. Without court intervention under the federal religious freedom law, Dort would have been forced to violate its religious doctrine and pay directly as a self-insured institution for products that violated those same beliefs. In the name of gay rights, Jack Phillips was ordered by the state of Colorado to choose between his religious beliefs, which define marriage as between one man and one woman, and his livelihood as a small business owner after he declined to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. At the time, the Colorado state constitution still prohibited same-sex marriages. The Colorado Civil Rights Commission nevertheless ordered Phillips to change his policies, retrain his staff, and file quarterly reports with the state proving compliance. Unable to do so without violating his religious beliefs, Phillips ceased taking wedding orders, losing about 40% of his business. In 2018, the U.S. Supreme Court found that the commission, despite its duty of neutrality, had instead acted with hostility toward Phillips' religious views in violation not of the RFRA, but the First Amendment. And in the name of transgender rights, a college in Ohio disciplined a longtime philosophy professor for declining to comply with a transgender student's demands to be addressed by the student's preferred pronouns. Shawnee State University refused to even consider a request for an accommodation on the basis of religion for Nicholas Merriweather, a devout Christian who believes that one's sex is fixed from conception and immutable. During a hearing for a grievance filed by the faculty union on Merriweather's behalf, the university provost made clear that he would not discuss the academic freedom and religious discrimination aspects of the case and acted in a manner so hostile that the union representatives was not able to present the grievance. Merriweather's grievance eventually got green-lighted by a federal appeals court. The Sixth Circuit found that Shawnee State did not apply its pronoun policy neutrally, and instead exhibited hostility toward Merriweather's religious beliefs. In lieu of further legislation, the school settled, paying Merriweather $400,000 in attorney fees and punitive damages and rescinding his disciplinary action. He remains on faculty and is no longer bound by a policy that violates his beliefs. All three suffered a violation of their religious rights, but many do not believe their expressions deserve protection for one reason. They find those expressions odious, but that's why religious freedom laws are necessary in the first place. Iowa's new law doesn't create any new avenues for discrimination. It recognizes that our right to free expression deserves protection from more than just federal intrusion. And because of those new protections, Iowans who fear their religious rights are getting trampled now get their day in court in a venue closer to home. And an editorial fellow, David Chung, writes, "The Battle for the School Library. Parents on the front lines 55 years ago and today. In the last few years, school libraries have become ground zero in the culture wars. I am no stranger to library controversies. I remember when my father read the Riot Act to my school librarian 55 years ago. My father was a college professor, an academic, and a gentleman. He loved books and encouraged me and my siblings to read. Our house was filled with books, ranging from advanced mathematics to pulp science fiction. He was not given to anger and was rarely confrontational, but in this incident, he let the librarian have it. This incident occurred during my second grade year at a public K-12 school, where a single library served students across all grades. My class went to the library to choose books to read. Students were permitted to select either fiction or nonfiction. Since I was fascinated by military aircraft, I chose a classic reference book, Jane's All the World's Aircraft. When I went to check the book out, the librarian told me that I couldn't because it was from the big side of the library. Even as a child, I was upset. The book was exactly what I wanted to read. I couldn't understand why the librarian wouldn't allow me to have it. He said the book was reserved for the secondary school students. When I got home, I mentioned the incident to my father, and he couldn't believe it. The following day, he drove me to school, and we marched into the library. I don't think he raised his voice, that was not his style, but my dad made it clear that it was ridiculous to prevent me from reading material that was more advanced than my grade level. He talked about encouraging rather than stifling my curiosity. Needless to say, after that day, I could check out any book in the library. Well, things have come full circle. 21 years later, my son was in second grade at the same school. His class had some reading time, and he had forgotten his book at home. My son was a precocious reader, and the teacher sent him to the library to get a replacement book. He was reading The Hobbit at home, so he found a copy in the library and took it to the desk to check it out. Just like 21 years ago, the librarian said that he could not check the book out because it came from the big side of the library. Upholding a family tradition, I drove my son to school the following day, and we marched into the library together. I explained that my son could read The Hobbit because he was already reading it. I made it clear that librarians should encourage a child's enthusiasm for reading and support their aspirations to explore more advanced literature. Some say that battle over school libraries today is about whether to censor certain types of books. I disagree. In my own experience, and later that of my son, we encountered a form of censorship when the librarian restricted access to certain books due to our ages. However, my father and I intervened and overruled the librarians. The issue isn't over whether to censor certain types of books, rather, it is over who gets to do the censoring. I know many of my conservative friends are up in arms about the highly sexualized content being made available in our public school libraries. Whether you call it censorship or selection, the fact remains that someone decides which books are included in the library and which are not. Educators say that professionals should be making those decisions, but in 2016, two of Cedar Rapids' three high schools fired their librarians. Regardless, in a debate over who makes decisions about our schools, I am always going to side with parents. To be honest, libraries are not among my top concerns about our schools. I might be more concerned if students were actually reading books and using the library. Maybe the solution is to do away with the school libraries altogether. Turning to the community letters and today's editorial cartoon, this is from Michael Ramirez, a syndicated cartoonist distributed by Creators Syndicate. It is a drawing of tomorrow's expected eclipse. We have the dark moon in front of the bright sun. The dark moon, almost completely obscuring the sun, is labeled social media conspiracies, and the corona of the sun around that says intelligence. The first letter is from Janice Meagle, board chairperson, June Klein Bacon, executive director of the Brain Injury Alliance of Iowa. Brain injury prevalence rises in Iowa. This spring, the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services released updated figures on brain injury in Iowa, showing that more than 600,000 Iowans have experienced a brain injury. This figure surpasses the combined populations of Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, Davenport, Sioux City, and Council Bluffs. Much slower to heal than other injuries, a brain injury is often a chronic condition requiring support to keep a job and to navigate physical, cognitive, financial, and other invisible challenges. Challenges inconceivable to most of us. The Brain Injury Alliance of Iowa provides a statewide, fee-free neuro-resource facilitation program for Iowans with brain injuries and their families. Our certified brain injury specialists aid individuals in navigating recovery, adapting, and accommodating changes. They help access to necessary services and support for living well with brain injury. Remember, brain injury is the last thing on your mind until it becomes the only thing. Janice Meagle and June Klein Bacon from the Brain Injury Alliance of Iowa. Next, Dwight Baldwin, the president of Iowa State Grange Kellogg, writes, "Legislature can reform pharmacy benefit managers now." Medications can significantly improve the quality of life for many patients dealing with long-term conditions such as arthritis, diabetes, and hypertension. For rural patients especially, getting our needed prescriptions isn't always easy. Fortunately, the Iowa legislature is on the verge of passing a bill that would help ensure patients can access affordable medications at their trusted local pharmacies and help Iowa save on prescription drug costs. The bill, HF 2401, passed the House with a near unanimous vote and is now ready to be passed in the Senate. HF 2401 would rein in insurance middlemen, known as pharmacy benefit managers, preventing them from continuing to squeeze out independent pharmacies with unfair contracts. This legislation also would save the state government money by creating more competition and transparency in the PBM market. Iowa legislators need to make this bill a priority and pass it as soon as possible to help ensure that Iowa's rural patients have access to local, independent pharmacies. Dwight Baldwin, President, Iowa State Grange Kellogg. Next, Bob Sanchez of West Burlington writes, "Competition should improve in all schools. I think it's great the parents have more choices about their kids' education. Competition brings out the best in everyone. It's better than if families were to have one choice and know they can't go anywhere else. Maybe these schools should step up and get better so parents won't want to take their kids to another school. It's their tax money, so it should follow them to the school they want their kids to go to. Schools should stick to education and let parents teach on other matters." Bob Sanchez of West Burlington. And the final letter is from Tom Pyron of Cedar Rapids. "Will CR hold new Google accountable for use of resources?" The Friday, March 29th Gazette had three separate distinct articles that were related, although not at first glance. The front page story of the completion of the floodgate at 12th Avenue, the $750,000 fish kill in southwest Iowa, and the editorial regarding Google's $576 million data center in Cedar Rapids. How are all these related? Water. The 12th Avenue floodgate will protect Cedar Rapids from flooding as development upstream, along with abandonment of planned buffers to absorb rainfall, has increased flood risk downstream. Now a big investment win for Cedar Rapids, the Google Data Center comes with the city's gift of reduced water discharge rates. The data center at first glance appears as a huge windfall by the city, attracting a major investment. But it must be realized that large tech companies' footprint drains water supplies and availability at alarming rates. Look no further than Microsoft's OpenAI complex in Goodyear, Arizona, that is projected to gulp 56 million gallons of water per year. This is the equivalent water supply to fulfill 700 families' needs. Linn County, as of 2024, still isn't considered to be in an extreme drought, as per drought.gov. Similarly, Arizona's Lake Mead and Lake Powell also are at historically low levels. Does the city have a plan to address and monitor water usage of one large company that potentially could negatively affect every resident in the city? We cannot afford to take our natural resources for granted. Tom Pyron of Cedar Rapids. And some quotes of the week. First, we have Governor Kim Reynolds as she signed legislation ending a requirement that membership on state boards and commissions be gender balanced. Governor Reynolds said, "I believed then, as I still do now, that our focus should always be on appointing the most qualified people, and that includes engaged citizens with a genuine interest in serving their state or local government, as well as individuals with valuable experience that directly relates to that position." Next, Renee Mente, great-niece of Raymond U. Schlamp, who was killed in action during World War II. His remains were identified by DNA testing, and he was laid to rest Saturday. Ms. Mente says, "Stories flowed every time we saw his picture. It was just part of our history. We never dreamed anything else would come. We just couldn't believe it." Mazie Stillwell, public affairs director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Iowa, reacting to Governor Kim Reynolds signing religious freedom legislation. Stillwell says, "By signing this bill, the governor and Republican lawmakers who passed it are saying it's okay to discriminate against our neighbors and then mask it as protecting our right to religious freedom." And State Senator Jeff Edler, Republican State Senator, speaking in favor of a bill that would provide liability protection for pesticide companies against lawsuits involving product labeling. Senator Edler says, "We're dealing with billions of dollars in lawsuits against the farm industry. The reality is that money is coming out of farmers' pockets." You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 7th, 2024. I am your reader, Sharon Felded, on the Iowa Radio Reading Service. My newspaper does say that there are storms likely today, and it is going to be windy, which I can confirm. When I went out to get the newspaper out of my driveway, it was very windy. Turning to today's obituaries, Larry Reeve of Cedar Rapids, Larry Cecil Reeve, born January 12, 1942. After a long and valiant struggle, Larry succumbed to siege by cancer on April 1st at the Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Larry served in the Army, where he was stationed in Taiwan. He began his career at Rockwell Collins in 1973 and retired in 2013 as a principal software engineer. While he highly valued his work and his colleagues, he enjoyed discovering and exploring new interests in the years of his retirement. For many years, Larry conducted a software business from home. He provided a popular software graphics viewer through shareware and enjoyed interactions with customers across the globe. Funeral service will be on Tuesday, April 9th at 4 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. A visitation will take place 1 hour prior to the service, starting at 3 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel stateroom. Randy L. Hansel, age 70, of Peoria, Illinois, died peacefully in his sleep at the loft on March 26th. He was an interior design manager at Bergner's department store. He retired when the store closed. Timothy Whiteside Funeral and Cremation is handling the arrangements. Patricia A. Bentley, known as Pat, age 71, passed from this life on March 27th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. In agreement with Pat's wishes, cremation has taken place. A funeral mass will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 13th at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church, located at 1350 Lyndhurst Drive in Hiawatha, where a rosary will be recited at 10 a.m. The Reverend Emmanuel Fenelis will officiate the mass. A celebration of Pat's life will follow mass until 3 p.m. in Seton Hall. Private committal services will take place at a later date at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Funeral Home Cremation in Marion is assisting the family with arrangements. Pat helped her husband start his own business and spent many nights doing the company bookwork. She was active in her children's lives as a homeroom mom, chauffeur, Girl Scout leader, and as their number one fan in the stands. She was also just a phone call away when you needed advice. If you stopped by for a visit, you were likely offered one of her delicious chocolate chip cookies. Wilma Jean Dyer, age 85, of Cedar Rapids, passed away April 3rd at Cottage Grove in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held 11 a.m. Wednesday, April 10th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation in Marion, with Pastor Robin Tyner officiating. Family will greet friends 1 hour prior to service. Burial will follow at Memory Garden Cemetery in Iowa City. Wilma was a member of Stonebridge Church and enjoyed the Chicago Cubs, the Iowa Hawkeyes, and the Game Show Network. Robert Henderson, known as Bob of Coggin, age 102, passed away March 27th in his home. A visitation will be held Friday, April 12th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Historical Hall, Main Street, Coggin. A memorial service will be Saturday, April 13th at 2 p.m. at Zion Presbyterian Church in Coggin. Burial will be later with the immediate family. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting the family. Bob served in the Cavalry Division of the U.S. Army at Fort Riley, Kansas from 1945 to 46. After service, he worked in local banks and was a member of the Linn County State Bank Board of Directors for 25 years. Along with farming, he was secretary treasurer for the Coggin School District and later business manager for the North Linn Community District. Bob was instrumental in the reorganization of the Coggin, Troy Mills, and Walker schools and served as treasurer for the Iowa Association of School Business Officials. Bob believed it was important to give back to the community and during his lifetime gave over 200 years of service. He helped establish the Coggin Historical Society and Coggin Community Memorial Foundation. He was a member of the Zion Presbyterian Church, Mecca Order of Eastern Star, a 75-year member of the Masonic Lodge, and the longest-serving Masonic District Lecturer in the state of Iowa. Edward Richard Allen III, known as Rick of Cedar Rapids, age 79, passed peacefully in his sleep at home after a battle with cancer. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, April 13th, from 3 to 6 p.m., at the Monarch Room at TN Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. Military rites will be held at 3 p.m. at the beginning of the celebration. Rick was a Navy veteran, proudly serving in Puerto Rico during the Vietnam War. He was a carpenter at the University of Iowa, retiring in 2010. Rick enjoyed reading, tinkering, and traveling. He was an avid Iowa Hawkeyes fan and enjoyed watching sports on television. Rick also liked to garden and bake, especially delicious pies and cookies. Rosemary Frost, 87, of Hiawatha, died March 20th at the Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha after a courageous battle with cancer. Funeral Mass, 11 a.m. Friday, April 12th at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. Friends may visit with the family, beginning at 10 a.m. at the church. Burial to follow at 2 p.m., Sancta Maria Cemetery in Gilbertville. TN Funeral Home is caring for Rosemary and her family. Rosemary loved time spent with her family and friends. Scott Level of Cocoa, Florida, passed on Tuesday, February 6th in the early morning. He was surrounded by loved ones and had a brief battle with cancer. He was 65. After he finished school, Scott joined the U.S. Navy, where he proudly served his country, after which he settled in Cocoa. A gypsy spirit at heart, Scott was passionate about motorcycles and rock and roll. He founded and was president of Saints MC and also served as secretary in his later years. Scott was known for his quick wit and dry sense of humor, but also for his compassion toward people. Scott was a pillar of support for his loved ones, friends, and MC community. Dale L. Barnes, Jr., age 69, of Anamosa, passed away on the morning of March 31st at St. Luke's Hospital following an extended illness. Funeral service will be held 11 a.m. Saturday morning, April 13th, at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Marion. Interment will be in the Czech National Cemetery. Pastor Andrew Noble will officiate at the services. Visitation will be held from Friday, April 12th, from 3 until 7 at the Getch Funeral Home in Anamosa. Dale was a hard worker, dedicating 42 years to law enforcement. He retired from the Jones County Sheriff's Office in 2019. He was elected to multiple terms as mayor of Anamosa, as he enjoyed making a difference in his community. He also enjoyed working at the Wapsipinicon State Park and for Jones Conservation. Lyle Edward Jensen, age 95, of Cedar Rapids, died April 1st at Mercy Medical Center. Services, 2 p.m. Tuesday, April 9th at TN Funeral Home by Pastor Craig Brown. Burial, Maple Grove Cemetery in Audubon. Friends may visit with the family on Tuesday from 1 to 2 p.m. at TN Funeral Home. Lyle worked as the office manager at Lumberland for 31 years, retiring in 1992. Lyle was a longtime member of the First Lutheran Church and member of Crescent Masonic Lodge No. 25. Lyle was an avid square dancer and enjoyed woodworking, his rose gardening, traveling, and wintering in Arizona. William Charles Berry, known as Bill of Cedar Rapids, died unexpectedly but peacefully in his sleep in January 25th, 2024, at his home in Guatemala. He was born February 23, 1951. Bill studied at the University of Ghana and remained on the continent to travel to other countries. This project changed his perspective of life, and he enrolled in the School for International Training in the World Issues Program. Bill collected a variety of succulents, his pride and joy, and had a variety of fruit trees and large crops, much appreciated by family, friends, and neighbors. He loved nature and led his family on exciting trips where they explored national parks and caves, went whitewater rafting, climbed volcanoes and pyramids, and wandered jungle trails. He was very interested in cultures and in learning as much as possible about different parts of the world. Bill enjoyed sports and especially loved watching his beloved Iowa Hawkeyes. A memorial visitation will be held at St. Jude Church on Friday, April 12th from 9 to 9:45, followed by a funeral mass at 10. A celebration of life will be held at Parlor City in Cedar Rapids from 10 to 1 p.m. on Saturday, April 13th. Phyllis Brack, age 93, formerly of 14 Montrose Avenue, Cedar Rapids, passed into eternal life surrounded by her loving family on February 23rd at Bickford of Marion. Celebration of life for Phyllis will be held on Wednesday, April 10th from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Following the celebration of life, there'll be a time for prayers led by Deacon Edward Martin. Interment will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Turning to the sports page, end of an era has arrived. Final 40 minutes await Clark and the Hawkeyes in title game tilt with the Mighty Gamecocks by Jeff Linder of the Gazette in Cleveland. As they traversed through the NCAA women's basketball tournament, the Iowa Hawkeyes became a big game magnet. "I keep feeling like we're playing a game everybody wants to see," Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said. "The LSU game, the UConn game, now this. This. It gets no bigger than this. Led by maybe the greatest player of all time, Iowa will try to slay Goliath for the second straight year." The second-ranked Hawkeyes, 34-4, faced number one South Carolina, 37-0, for the national championship today at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. Tip-off is at 2 p.m. Iowa time in a game that will be televised by ABC. "I hope it's the most watched game ever," South Carolina coach Don Staley said. "I hope everybody gets what they want out of it." Of course, only one team will truly get what it wants. "It's hard when your season ends no matter what stage it is," said Iowa's Caitlin Clark, who will wear her soon-to-be-retired black and gold 22 uniform for the final time. "I think it's the same thing right now. I don't want this to end, whether it's with a win or with a loss." Iowa stunned South Carolina 77-73 in the 2023 national semifinals. That is the Gamecocks' only blemish in the last 80 games. In a game that drew an average of 14.2 million viewers on ESPN, the most watched women's basketball game on record, Iowa edged Connecticut 71-69 on Friday night. Bluter was right. Everybody wants to see the Hawkeyes. Like last year's encounter with South Carolina, the Hawkeyes face an uphill climb. The Gamecocks outscore their opponents by an average of 29.6 points per game. Iowa is a 6.5-point underdog. "That is a team that just doesn't have a lot of weaknesses," Bluter said. "It's really hard to defend them. One person can't stop 6'7" post Camila Cardoso. There's no way. I don't know if two or three can stop her, to be quite honest." Clark dropped 41 points on the Gamecocks last year. "You can't help but love the way she dissects the game. Her game is simple but powerful," Staley said. "How do you defend fundamental basketball with fundamental defense? You can't. She's going to win every time." It will be the 139th consecutive game in which Clark and Martin are in the starting lineup. Gabby Marshall will make her 137th career start. With 3.9 seconds left and Iowa nursing a one-point lead Friday, Marshall drew a key foul on Connecticut's Aaliyah Edwards. The aftermath has been ugly. "I've gotten a lot of hate comments on social media," Marshall said. "I don't know. I'm not the one that made the call, so I'm not sure why they're mad at me personally." Edwards was called for a moving screen as Marshall pursued UConn's Paige Beckers. "If it's the right call, it's the right call. It's out of my control to make the calls, but personally, I thought it was an illegal screen, and it's not like it was the first one of the game," said Marshall, who said she has deleted her social media account. Iowa tipped off its semifinal game at 9:30 p.m. Friday, Cleveland time. It was 2 or 3 a.m. when Hawkeye heads hit their pillows. So preparation for today is somewhere at the intersection of game planning and rest. "Scouting reports are really good to look at and memorize at this point, but not so much to go on the floor with," Bluter said. "Legs are really, really important, especially when you're going against a South Carolina team that is so deep. You don't have the advantage of wearing people down." Iowa's season began October 15th with a crossover at Kinnick. It will end nearly 6 months later, as long as it can go. "We're not sick of each other yet," Bluter said. So that is number 2 Iowa, who are 34-4, versus number 1 South Carolina, who are 37-0, in the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament National Final at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse in Cleveland. Tip-off is 2 p.m. local time on KCRG or a live stream on ESPN3, ESPN Plus, or the ESPN app. On the radio, it will be on the Hawkeye Radio Network affiliates. This says Iowa's next game. This is it, the end of the road until an exhibition next season. What to know? Iowa has reached the championship game for the second straight season. The Hawkeyes fell to LSU in the final last year, 102-85. Iowa shocked South Carolina 77-73 in last year's semifinals. That marks the Gamecocks' lone loss in the last 80 games. The Hawkeyes rallied from a 12-point first-half deficit to beat number 10 Connecticut 71-69 on Friday. South Carolina handled number 11 North Carolina State 78-59, outscoring the Wolfpack 29-6 in the third quarter. Today marks the final game for five Iowa seniors. Caitlin Clark, 3,921 career points. Kate Martin, Gabby Marshall, Sharon Goodman, and Molly Davis, out, knee injury. Clark and Martin have started 139 games, Marshall 137. Camilla Cardoso, 6'7" senior post, leads South Carolina at 14.1 points and 9.4 rebounds per game. Iowa leads the nation in scoring, 91.4 points per game, and assists, 21.0 per game, while Clark is tops in scoring, 31.7 points per game, and assists, 9.0 per game. South Carolina is a 6.5-point favorite. The Gamecocks were NCAA champions in 2017 and 2022. And turning to the time machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. Accessibility in Iowa. Blue signs first appeared on Cedar Rapids buildings in the 1970s, by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. The blue and white sign depicting a stick figure in a wheelchair, known as the International Symbol for Accessibility, first appeared on buildings in Cedar Rapids, not on parking places. The signs were used to indicate a building was accessible to people who did not have full mobility. Even then, the buildings may not have fully accessible restrooms or elevators. The signs simply meant people with mobility issues could get into the building. The signs were created at the urging of the Cedar Rapids Employment of the Handicapped Committee and the Governor's Committee for the Employment of the Handicapped. The Senate voted 38-0 on February 23, 1972, to add protections for physically and mentally handicapped persons to the state's Civil Rights Code. The bill passed the House, and Governor Robert Ray signed it into law March 22. State law only required ramp access for public buildings, but legislation to include new or remodeled private businesses was pending, according to Morris Johnson, who represented the governor's committee. He encouraged cities to get the ball rolling on their own. That's what Cedar Rapids did. Evelyn Villanes of Urbandale, executive secretary of the governor's committee, addressed an April 18, 1972 meeting of the Cedar Rapids Citizens Committee on Employment for the Handicapped, headed by William Pohorski, at the Hotel Roosevelt in Cedar Rapids. Villanes, who wore a leg brace and used crutches, brought with her the blue plaque used to designate accessible buildings. She told the committee that people with disabilities were routinely denied jobs, refused service in restaurants, could not use public restrooms, and faced barriers when trying to vote. She said a disabled person would even have difficulty filing a complaint at the Civil Rights Commission in Des Moines because the office was on the second floor, reached by a narrow stairway. Johnson, representing the governor's committee, asked the Cedar Rapids City Council on April 26, 1972, to adopt provisions requiring ramp access to new buildings and to existing buildings undergoing remodeling. The Cedar Rapids Building Code was being updated at that time, and Building Department Director Ed Winter said adding the provisions would be simple. The revised code required public buildings to have ramps and toilet facilities designed for people using wheelchairs, the Gazette reported the next day. Drinking fountains, railings, and steps that can be used by the handicapped are also included. It was the first building code in the state to make those provisions mandatory in new and remodeled buildings. Cedar Rapids buildings officials and members of the City Council all earn a salute for reasonable and compassionate action that will help make the whole community more livable for all, the Gazette said in an editorial. Davenport followed Cedar Rapids' lead in December 1972. In May 1973, the Cedar Rapids Citizens Committee notified businesses in a 20-block downtown area of the committee's intent to survey street-level entrances for accessibility. Tom Aller, the city's intra-governmental coordinator and a member of the committee, said, "We're not going to be harassing anyone. The survey will be done in a non-threatening way to simply find out what barriers there are to the handicapped. If a business was accessible, 77 of the 175 surveyed were, it would get a blue and white decal to display. Some businesses that didn't qualify asked what they could do to merit a decal. Sometimes only minor modifications were necessary." On January 27, 1977, the first four handicapped parking signs were installed in downtown Cedar Rapids. A city permit was required to use the spaces. The Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, championed by Iowa's U.S. Senator Tom Harkin, refined the disability parking rules and made them uniform across the nation. The signs would be the blue and white universal symbol created in 1968 by Suzanne Kofed, a Danish design student. As more parking spaces were marked with the blue signs, the problem of able-bodied people parking in the reserved spots began. Police began issuing tickets. In 1995, the Iowa legislature increased the fine for illegal parking in a handicapped space from $50 to $100. And just a few things to do this week. There's some music. Crazy Train, the country's number one Ozzy Osbourne tribute act, will perform from 7 to 10 p.m. Thursday at the Ideal Theater and Bar, 213 16th Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. That cost is $25 to $40. In theater, there is The Lady from the Sea, about a woman in 19th century Norway living a safe and secure life with a loving family who is haunted by the memory of more exciting times. When a stranger tempts her with the chance to return to those times, she is faced with an impossible choice, fulfilling her deepest desires of remaining within the safety of her comfortable home, or is there a third way? That's 7:30 to 9 on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Coe College, Dow's Fine Arts Center, Dow's Theater, 1221 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids, and that is $15. And also in theater, The Hallelujah Girls. Hilarity abounds when the feisty females of Eden Falls, Georgia, decide to shake up their lives. The action in this rollicking southern comedy takes place in Spa-Dee-Da, the abandoned church-turned-day spa where this group of friends gathers every Friday afternoon. And that is 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday at Giving Tree Theater, 752 10th Street in Marion, and the cost is $27. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 7th, 2024. I have been your reader, Sharon Faldudo, selecting the articles. Remember that we do welcome your comments. If you have anything to say about what I have or have not been reading, welcome your comments. And you can access a recording of this or any other Iris recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening. And I have been your reader, Sharon Faldudo, reading to you from my kitchen table, looking at the wind and the rain outside. Thanks.